From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, why fetal alcohol syndrome may be the gravest threat to Native Americans since Columbus's 1492 expedition. Writer Michael Doris is part Indian, and his adopted Sioux son has the disabilities linked to the syndrome. It's the subject of Doris's book, The Broken Cord. Also today, we examine the trivial things that we really spend time thinking about. Nicholson Baker's novel, The Mezzanine, catalogs one man's thoughts during his lunch hour. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the music of father and son tenor saxophonists Von Freeman and Chico Freeman. And critic Maureen Corrigan reflects on how the television show 30-something is dealing with cancer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Sharon Green. Lawyers for former President Reagan today said he plans to invoke executive privilege to avoid complying with a federal judge's order to turn over excerpts of his presidential diaries. They're being sought by defense lawyers for former National Security aide John Poindexter, the latest of the Iran-Contra defendants to come to trial. On another issue, the judge presiding in the case ordered Reagan to give a videotaped deposition in the case. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
Judge Harold Green declared that not even a former president may be excused from testifying in a criminal trial where he's alleged to have specific, relevant, and material evidence. But the judge said to protect the confidentiality of presidential deliberations and to protect the national security, Mr. Reagan's testimony would be taken before the February 20th trial date and videotaped. That, said the judge, would allow the president to ask for recesses where necessary to consult his lawyer and Bush administration officials and to appeal the judge's rulings on specific matters if need be. The judge gave Mr. Reagan and Bush administration officials until Friday to decide what they want to do next. Mr. Reagan or the Bush administration could appeal. But if Mr. Reagan decides not to challenge the judge's order, he will be questioned by defense and prosecution lawyers on some 150 specified subject areas, with follow-ups permitted. The judge will preside, and the videotape will be played for the jury. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
U.S. District Judge Robert Aguilar went on trial today in San Francisco on charges of racketeering and conspiracy. Aguilar, one of the few Hispanics on the federal bench, is only the fourth sitting federal judge ever indicted. Cy Musiker has details.
Aguilar is the first federal judge ever indicted on racketeering charges. He sat in the courtroom today next to the men who are alleged to be his co-conspirators: Abe Chapman, a reputed mafia hitman known as the Trigger, and Rudy Tam, a Teamster official convicted of embezzling union funds. Judge Aguilar is accused of trying to influence other judges on behalf of Tam and Chapman, of lying to federal agents, and leaking wiretap information. The prosecuting attorneys from the U.S. Justice Department's Public Integrity Section announced today a list of witnesses they'll call, among them two federal judges who Aguilar allegedly tried to influence. Aguilar's attorneys lost their first round in the trial this morning when the court refused to throw out 1,500 wiretap recordings on which much of the government's case is based. For National Public Radio, I'm Cy Musiker in San Francisco.
A U.S. Air Force F-111 bomber with two crew members crashed into the North Sea off the eastern coast of England today. Britain's defense ministry says one body was recovered and a search is underway for the second crewman. A U.S. military spokesman said the bomber, based at Upper Heyford, went down during a routine training mission. Prices were higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials gained nearly 20 points to close at 2622.52. Advances led declines 4-3 in trading of 131 million shares. This is NPR News. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev called on the Communist Party's Central Committee today to abandon its guaranteed political monopoly and allow a multi-party system. The Bush administration reacted to Gorbachev's historic proposition with praise for democracy and political pluralism, but kept silent on the Soviet constitutional changes that Gorbachev's proposal would require. The arrival today of a plane carrying relief supplies in the besieged southern Sudanese town of Juba was the first such help the town has seen since the Sudanese government lifted the three-month ban on relief flights. About 250,000 people are facing starvation in Juba. The plane took off from Nairobi, from where the BBC's Peter Biles sent this report.
The plane, a Hercules C-130 transport aircraft operated by the Lutheran World Federation, took off from Nairobi before daybreak and landed in Juba shortly after 7 o'clock this morning with a consignment of 15 tons of Italian-donated maize. At present, Juba has only enough food left to last the town's population about a week. In the past 5 days, the Hercules had made 2 previous attempts to fly from Nairobi to Juba. On both occasions, it was turned back by Sudanese civil aviation officials because of confusion over permits. This afternoon, the plane made a second run to Juba, while a Boeing 707, chartered from Sudan Airways, which has been the only relief flight operating in the past 2 months, was also expected to transport another 30 tons of food.
The BBC's Peter Biles reporting. The Reverend Jesse Jackson met in London today with British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Jackson said they agreed to disagree about maintaining sanctions against the South African government. Thatcher lifted cultural and scientific sanctions against Pretoria after President F.W. de Klerk announced on Friday that he was ending restrictions on anti-apartheid groups and promised to free jailed black nationalist leader Nelson Mandela. Jackson visits South Africa on Wednesday. I'm Sharon Green, reporting for National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Michael Doris was one of the first unmarried men to legally adopt a very young child. It was 1971, and he was 26, a self-described ex-would-be hippie. Doris adopted a 3-year-old named Adam, who was diagnosed as mentally retarded. But Doris later discovered his son really had fetal alcohol syndrome, or FAS. It's a combination of mental disabilities and physical deformities that can result if the mother drank heavily during pregnancy. According to an article in Sunday's New York Times, an estimated 8,000 alcohol-damaged babies are born each year. On some Indian reservations, 25% of all children are afflicted. My guest Michael Doris says FAS is one of the gravest dangers facing Native Americans today. It's the subject of his book, The Broken Cord. Doris is an adjunct professor of Native American Studies at Dartmouth College and a novelist. He's part Modoc Indian, and his son Adam is Sioux. Doris is married to the writer Louise Erdrich, with whom he collaborated on the novels Love Medicine and The Beet Queen. They have 6 children, 3 that he adopted before their marriage in 1981, and 3 they had together. I spoke with Doris when The Broken Cord was published over the summer, and he told me why he wanted to adopt a child when he was single.
I come from a long line of single parents who happen to be women, but my mother and her mother and her mother all had been widowed early and had raised children, I hope successfully, without being a double parent family. So that was my role model. It wasn't that I self-consciously planned to be a single parent, but rather that I got to a point in my life where I really wanted children. And the way to get children, if I wasn't married and I was a male, was to adopt.
What kinds of questioning did you have to undergo before you were allowed to adopt? Were there certain suspicions against you because you were a single man?
Well, I think it was looked upon as a real strange thing, because I went through this process in Alaska, where I was living at the time, and the only agency that even answered my letter of inquiry was Catholic Charities. And I had my initial interview with a nun there, and she broached the subject, was I doing this by any chance because I was an anthropologist? And that question really threw me for a loop, as if I had intended to raise a child as a kind of experiment. And so I said, no, you know, I'm doing it because I want to be a father. Then a social worker came out, and there was a period of kind of feeling each other out as me trying to figure out what questions she was asking and what was the hidden agenda, and I think her trying to figure out why I was making this petition. But after a period of time, we simply became friends and talked about being parents, and she was anticipating parenthood too, so it became very natural.
Were you specifically looking for a Native American baby?
I felt that as an Indian person myself, I probably could have more to offer for a Native American child. The other aspect was, I think it was probably easier for me to get a placement because some mothers would specify that they would like their child raised in a household where they would have access to their own ethnic heritage and background, and that I could offer.
Mm-hmm. Well, the child who you were offered was Adam, who you adopted. He was 3 at the time, and he was diagnosed as mentally retarded. Did you have any reservations about taking on the responsibilities of a retarded child?
I didn't believe the diagnosis. I was, as you say, in my early 20s. This was just after the 1960s. It was a period of time, I think, when people of my generation were ultimately very optimistic. and also a period of time where to believe anything other than nurture determined the outcome of a child was considered quite bad taste and perhaps even politically wrong. I certainly was in that camp. I believed that nurture was everything. And when I heard that my son was young for his age, which was the euphemism for mildly retarded, I actually looked upon that as a good thing because I figured he would be more my own child being young. It would be almost as if I were adopting him when he was 1.5 or 2 rather than 3.
Mm-hmm. He was also abused before you adopted him, abused by his mother. He had been tied to the bars of the crib. He was half starved. Did you know all that at the time?
I did. I also knew that his mother had been an alcoholic, and I knew that she had died from alcohol poisoning. But at the time, again, that was not considered pertinent information. If I had had the prescience to go and look in a medical textbook in 1971 and look up alcohol and see if it was a problem, what I would have found in the pharmacological textbook that was used in most medical schools was the warning that the only reason not to drink alcohol during pregnancy was that you might gain weight, but that though it crossed the placental barrier, it did the developing fetus no harm. That was the information in the textbooks at that time, and certainly nobody told me that this was something to be particularly concerned about, and I wasn't.
Well, what led you to finding out about fetal alcohol syndrome was your son's seizures. This wasn't a part of what was expected when your son was diagnosed as mildly retarded. And the seizures led you to a series of doctors who also didn't say anything about fetal alcohol syndrome. You found out about it by through a drug rehabilitation center.
It was almost 11 years after the adoption had been finalized. There had accumulated a series of discrete symptoms, both in terms of my son's physical problems, everything from poor hearing and eyesight and too many teeth in his mouth, curvature of the spine, poor balance, you name it, a whole range of things that had to do with the development of his bone structure and major organs, and then a whole series of behavioral problems as well. The fact that he found it very hard to learn new things. It took me, I would say 2 years to teach him to tie his shoes. It took until he was almost 8 before he was toilet trained. Each of these things I explained to myself as simply catching up, that he had been traumatized, that he was young for his age, and that there would be a breakthrough and everything would fall into place by the time he was 21. He would be able to do all these things. But nevertheless, because he was hyperactive in school, I did see a number of counselors, neurologists, psychologists, etc., all of whom had flashed warning signs, but nobody had a name to put to this collection of symptoms, which seemed unlike anything that was easily labeled. Then in 1981, I was doing some consulting work for the Bush Foundation on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. And I was at a sort of halfway house for teenage kids who had no place else to go. And there was a group came in who reminded me in subtle and yet unmistakable ways of my son and their demeanor and how they interacted with each other and how they watched television and how they stood and so forth. I said to the counselor, "Who are they and what's their story?" And he said to me, "They're FAS. In the world of Indian Affairs, there's a zillion acronyms, and I thought this was just another one, so I asked him what that was, and he said fetal alcohol syndrome, and then described the symptoms of fetal alcohol syndrome, and it was as if he were describing my son, though he had never met him, and it just blew me away.
My guest is Michael Doris, and his new book is called The Broken Cord, and it's a book about his adopted son, Adam, who has fetal alcohol syndrome. How did alcohol become such a problem for Indians? You talk about it a little bit historically in your new book.
Yeah, it's an issue of great debate. There is a stereotype that somehow Indians have, as a group, a lower tolerance for alcohol than non-Indians, and that's pretty much a myth. People who are Asian or Native American sometimes have what they call a flushing effect when they drink. That is, their skin flushes. But that is not going to stop anybody from being an alcoholic, and it doesn't mean that you have a smaller tolerance for alcohol necessarily. Every group has people more or less tolerant of alcohol. It has to do with how your liver processes ethanol. But the way that Indians learned about liquor, I think, has a great deal to do with it. There was no stimulant or depressant drugs among native tribes north of the Rio Grande before contact with Europeans. And like anything else, when it was introduced, people took its method of use from those who introduced it. And in the case of alcohol, it was trappers and traders who were deviant drinkers by European standards, and their practice became associated with Native American use because it always accompanied trade rituals and was, in some respects, incorporated into the drinking behavior. Not necessarily people were drunk, but how you act when you're drinking is different if you're at a fraternity party or if you're with the President of the United States. And a kind of devil-may-care attitude was associated with Indian drinking, though didn't mean that people were drunk. But in sense, in the long run, over generations, it becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy and does cause serious health and social problems.
It was very lucrative, too, for Europeans to sell alcohol to Native Americans. You compare it to today's cocaine rings.
Not only was it lucrative in a direct way, but it was lucrative also because if you're dealing with a trading partner who is drunk, they are much easier to take advantage of.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about fetal alcohol syndrome, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is writer Michael Doris. His new book is called The Broken Cord, and it's the story of his son, Adam, his adopted son, who has fetal alcohol syndrome. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is writer Michael Doris. In his new book, The Broken Cord, he tells of the discovery that his adopted Native American son has fetal alcohol syndrome. It's a disabling disease caused when a woman drinks during pregnancy. Doris is also the author of the novel A Yellow Raft in Blue Water, and he collaborates with his wife, writer Louise Erdrich. He's also an adjunct professor of Native American Studies and Anthropology at Dartmouth. We were talking about drinking among Native Americans. In the introduction to your book, your wife, Louise Erdrich, explains that she used to be a heavy drinker herself. Did you have drinking problems ever, too, when you were growing up near a reservation?
Well, I think it's the rare Indian person who is not affected by alcohol either directly or indirectly. Certainly, I had a period of my life in which I did drink too much, but I was lucky in that I came from a very sober family, as does Louise, and also it made me sick. And it made me sick enough that it really was a discouragement. After being sick several times, I thought, enough is enough. And so I was fortunate in the sense that my body stopped me, which is what happens actually to a lot of pregnant women in their first trimester. Morning sickness keeps them from drinking. And the problems oftentimes arise in a third trimester situation, which is when the brain is developing at its most accelerated rate.
Well, you're very aware of the fact that alcoholism, the high alcoholism rate among Indians, has to do with the victimization of Native Americans. Yet you say, although you know that the pregnant women who drink to excess during pregnancy, who are Native Americans, are victims, that you still can't forgive them for doing it.
Well, I don't mean to be judgmental, but I speak as a parent, and I speak as somebody who sees the effect of somebody's poor choice, bad judgment, ignorance, willful ignorance. I don't know what. I didn't know Adam's mother, but whatever she did has limited his possibilities for the rest of his life. And I don't think that is the kind of choice that one person in morality can make for another.
One of the symptoms of fetal alcohol syndrome is that you don't learn from your mistakes.
Right, yeah.
And you suspect that a lot of the pregnant women who drink are actually victims of fetal alcohol syndrome themselves.
I do think so. It's bad judgment dealing with abstractions, thinking and conceptualizing things having to do with time, money, relating a consequence to an action, are things that are very, very difficult for fetal alcohol victims to carry forth. Any question why, which requires imagination and anticipation, is going to be problematic for a person with this problem. So if a woman herself is a victim of fetal alcohol syndrome, she's very, very hard to counsel about why she shouldn't drink during pregnancy. And therefore, she may drink during pregnancy, and 9 months or 9 years after the fact, find herself, if in fact she keeps her child, which many FAS mothers don't do, with a child with great problems.
Mm-hmm. One of the most interesting things to me about your new book was watching you wrestle with yourself about what your opinion should be about how to deal with pregnant women who drink. You consider yourself politically very liberal, yet you found yourself having certain opinions that didn't fit in with the other opinions you had. For instance, you were seriously wondering, should women be forced to undergo sterilization if they have had several children who had fetal alcohol syndrome? Should mothers who are alcoholics and refuse to stop drinking be incarcerated during their pregnancy and be forced to not drink? Have you kind of taken a clear stand on where you stand on those issues now?
No, I was not seriously proposing those things, but rather I think this is primarily a woman's issue. And the ideas, those extreme examples that you mentioned, are ideas that have come from women who work on a daily basis with fetal alcohol children and mothers. I heard a story just the other day from one of those women who said that there was a lady that she knew who had had 4 fetal alcohol children, had abused them and abandoned them. They had been removed from her care. She was pregnant again, and she was drinking. And my friend said to her, "Why are you drinking, and why do you keep getting pregnant?" And this woman, who does not understand the situation because of her own impairment, said, "I love kids, and they keep taking them away from me, and so I keep having them." And this is the extreme case that we're talking about, not a person who can go to a detox center, not a person who can be educated and counseled, and through peer pressure of her sister or mother or daughter or husband, learn that this is not a good thing to do and be supported in that decision, but rather a person who absolutely cannot understand it because of her own impairment, who is going to bear a child that almost certainly will be impaired, because if you had 1 fetal alcohol child and you continue drinking, you're almost guaranteed to have more, and that child will then be the responsibility of the state for life. In that extreme situation, the women that I talked to about this have suggested that if nothing else works, to incarcerate someone until they dry out, until they can be put into the care of someone who can ensure that they will take care of themselves, is probably a better solution than doing nothing. And it's not a solution that anybody has come to easily, and I should add that it is a solution that is proposed only in instances where a woman has decided to bring a child to term.
Are you concerned about precedents it would set if there was incarceration of pregnant women?
I'm absolutely concerned about that. It is a moral gray area in which you have 2 competing rights, the right of an adult person to do whatever she wants, whenever she wants, and the right of a child for a whole life. And the people that I talked to about this came to the conclusion, very reluctantly, that if it was a choice between not allowing one right to be exercised for a couple of months versus an entire lifetime of retardation, that this was a difficult but necessary choice to make.
And do you side with that now, or?
Yes, I do. I wish, and I'm sorry to say this, but I wish that Adam's mother had been restrained from drinking somehow, preferably through counseling and peer counseling and supportive spouses and families, but anything that would have enabled my son to understand who he is and, to the extent that any of us understand it, why we're here, and to gain satisfaction out of some of the things that most people consider beautiful and wonderful. Yes, I wish he had that right.
My guest is writer Michael Doris, and his new book, The Broken Cord, is about his son, Adam, who has fetal alcohol syndrome. Adam is one of six children that you have. He's one of three who you adopted before you married Louise Erdrich. Your three other children are children that you and Louise had together. When Adam was 18, you decided to have him move out. I think so he could be, you live on a farm, it's pretty isolated. And I think your reason was this way he could live closer to a job and he'd be able to work
and
support himself. Yeah,
it was 20 when he moved
out. I'm sorry, excuse me.
Yes, it. He got to the point, at 21, the educational system kicks out. He was in a very good vocational training school in Hartford, Vermont, where I think it was the best possible place for him, but he couldn't continue there after 21. And their goal for all of their developmentally disabled students is to find them a job where they can have some sort of independence and satisfaction. And to do that, it was necessary for Adam to live in a place where he could get to and from work at odd hours, because the job he actually holds right now is a dishwasher at a truck stop, and sometimes he works on weekends, and sometimes he has a night shift, and sometimes a morning shift, and it would be nothing but chauffeuring for Louise and me if he were at home, and not really what he needed anyway. So he lives in a very, very good group home with a man and woman who take care of a number of young children and young adults who have problems. And it's within a 10-minute walk of where he works.
Mm-hmm. I know that you write full-time now, but you are a trained anthropologist and have studied mostly different Native American populations. How grave a problem do you think fetal alcohol syndrome represents now to Native Americans?
I think it is an extraordinarily serious problem. There are some communities on certain reservations, and it's not everywhere by any means, but there are some communities on certain reservations where it's estimated that by the turn of the century, if things progress as they are now going, that 40 or 50% of all children born will be impaired to some degree by maternal drinking. And that is a population that is terribly dependent on itself for limited resources and on the rest of the world for understanding and protection, which is the last thing that Indian people want or should need. But, for instance, with my son, if he has $10 and somebody says, I'll give you a donut if you give it to me, he'll give it to them, and he won't ask for change. If he had $10,000, he'd do exactly the same thing. If you're an Indian reservation that wants to get lease land back, and somebody offers a short-term, very small recompense for that, and you have a large proportion of the voting population who can't see the long-term consequence, you might make a wrong decision as a population. So I think it's a very dangerous thing. But it's also a very dangerous thing, I think, in the Soviet Union, in Japan, in other parts of the world where this problem is also on the rise.
Michael Doris, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Michael Doris' new book about his son with fetal alcohol syndrome is called The Broken Cord. It's published by Harper & Row. Doris is also the author of A Yellow Raft in Blue Water, which is a novel. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This music is from the CD Walking Tough by tenor saxophonist Von Freeman. He's got another CD out which features him and his son Chico Freeman, both on tenor saxophones. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Walking Tough and Freeman and Freeman. Also, we meet novelist Nicholson Baker. He's proud of the fact that he's written one book that'll never be made into a movie. That book, The Mezzanine, follows the mundane thoughts that preoccupy us, like straws that don't easily unsheathe, shoelaces that break, and thick memos that don't staple well. Also, critic Maureen Corrigan looks at how the characters in 30-something react to Nancy's cancer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Redlin. Iran-Contra trial defendant John Poindexter got most of what he wanted from the judge in his case as far as his former boss is concerned. Washington federal judge Harold Green today ordered former President Ronald Reagan to give a videotaped deposition and to turn 33 entries from his diaries over to his former national security advisor. Reagan immediately invoked executive privilege to avoid turning over the parts of his diaries Poindexter wants for his defense. The judge also gave Reagan and the Bush administration until Friday to use executive privilege on the matter of the videotaped testimony. However, a spokesman for Mr. Reagan refused comment on the deposition order. Invoking executive privilege will allow the former president to gain access to a secret filing with the judge in which Poindexter told why he needs the diaries. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev today called on his Communist Party colleagues to voluntarily give up their constitutionally guaranteed monopoly on political power. He said the party must end its dictatorial control over the government and the Soviet economy, and he endorsed a multi-party system without saying how quickly it should be allowed. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Gorbachev's appeal in a speech at a closed-door meeting of the party's Central Committee today comes in the wake of recent scandals that have toppled local communist leaders in several cities. It also follows a huge protest led by reformers within the party that stopped traffic throughout downtown Moscow yesterday. The protesters' chief demand was an end to the communist political monopoly. Gorbachev appears to have answered that demand, though his speech did not make clear just how much political competition he's proposing. The Central Committee meeting continues tomorrow. Members will debate Gorbachev's platform for political reform to be presented at a nationwide party congress now scheduled for midsummer. For National Public Radio, I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
In the Yugoslavian province of Kosovo, the newly formed opposition movement today rallied tens of thousands of ethnic Albanians for silent protest action to mourn the victims of recent clashes with police. It was the largest gathering in Kosovo in years. Sylvia Pojoli reports.
This afternoon, 20 to 30,000 ethnic Albanians gathered in the main street of Pristina for 2 minutes of silence. They all raised their hands in the V sign while hundreds of motorists honked their horns. Afterwards, the crowd dispersed, everyone rhythmically clapping their hands. This evening, thousands of people again gathered in the main street, carrying candles and shouting, "Glory to the dead!" In recent days, 27 ethnic Albanian demonstrators were killed in violent clashes with police. Today's actions are seen as part of the opposition's new peaceful strategy in demanding greater autonomy from Serbia, Yugoslavia's largest republic, and free, multi-party elections. In Pristina, this is Sylvia Podroli.
Prices were higher on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 20 points today. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Tenor saxophonist Earl Freeman, better known as Von Freeman, lives in Chicago and has made a few records. Tenor saxophonist Earl Freeman Jr., better known as Chico, lives in New York and has recorded many albums. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new Von Freeman album and a recording Father and Son made together in 1981.
Years ago, Chico Freeman was one of the most recorded and written about tenor saxophonists in jazz. His father, Von Freeman, has for the last few decades been a classic hometown celebrity, a fixture on the scene in Chicago, but little known outside of it. In 1981, when Von Freeman was 58 years old and Chico was 31, father and son met up in New York for a joint concert. A recording from that show has just been issued on the India Navigation label. It's called Freeman and Freeman. That's Von Freeman charging out of the gate. When members of the same family get together to sing, their voices often have a peculiar resonance. Physiological similarities and a common background let them really blend. That can be true for players of wind instruments, too. Chico Freeman inherited his father's lung power and grew up with his music all around him. So it's not surprising there are similarities in the way they phrase. But there are generational differences. Chico's sound is less harsh and more modern. Like almost every tenor saxophonist who came after John Coltrane, he's absorbed some of Coltrane's soaring sound and harmonic complexity. Most of the tracks on Freeman and Freeman are given over either to Von or Chico, but on a blues called Paying New York Dues, they solo back to back. Von goes first. Chico steps up after a few bars of piano from Mujal Richard Abrams. Freeman's father and son unwittingly reinforce a prejudice some fans of older jazz styles have, that the elders have more interesting tones than younger players do. Not to take anything away from Chico Freeman, but on this album, his father's sound catches my ear more. Von Freeman is the featured player on Freeman and Freeman, perhaps because he's made fewer albums than his son. Coincidentally, Von has another and even better new album out called Walkin' Tough. It was recorded last year for Chicago's Southport label. Von Freeman's gruff sound is a reminder that Chicago is the northernmost tip of the blues belt. You can trace his intensely vocal quality all the way back to plantation field hollers. His is the classic sound of a Chicago tenor. He has a lot in common with the most famous exponent of that saxophone style, the late Gene Ammons. In fact, Freeman and Ammons went to high school together. I'm told the thing that makes Chicago tenors so distinctive has to do with the way they breathe. They use diaphragm vibrato, which is more expressive but harder to control than the more usual throat vibrato. Freeman's vocalized tone and flexible pitch are eccentric, almost grotesque at times, but they help him get to the heart of the material, like on the classic ballad, Nature Boy. On most of the album, Walkin' Tough, Von Freeman is backed by one or another of Chicago rhythm sections. But he also plays a solo improvisation on Irving Berlin's How Deep is the Ocean. Unaccompanied solos are a Chicago tradition, but they date from the avant-garde of the 1960s, which was a formative influence on Chico Freeman. And that just goes to show that influence is a two-way street, that fathers can learn from sons as well as the other way around.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. Here's Von Freeman soloing on How Deep is the Ocean. This is Fresh Air. Nicholson Baker's first novel, The Mezzanine, takes place during a 30-second escalator ride. It's the narrator's lunch hour, and he's returning to his office on the mezzanine level after buying a pair of shoelaces at the CVS drugstore. That's the plot. What the book does is chronicle in obsessive detail all the trivial thoughts that preoccupy the character during his lunch break. I spoke to Baker last March when The Mezzanine first came out. It's just been published in paperback. Before Baker wrote The Mezzanine, he worked in an office as a securities analyst and a stockbroker. He told me he intended to write a novel about Wall Street, but the plot seemed artificial. He said all he really knew about was lunch breaks. In the novel, every thought is described in such detail that some require further elaboration and footnotes. For instance, thinking about the pleasure of rubbing one's foot on carpeting leads to this footnote.
When I pull a sock on, I no longer pre-bunch, that is, I don't gather the sock up into telescoped folds over my thumbs and then position the resultant donut over my toes, even though I believed for some years that this was a clever trick taught by admirable fresh-faced kindergarten teachers, and that I revealed my laziness and my inability to plan ahead by instead holding the sock by the ankle rim and jamming my foot to its destination, working the ankle a few times to properly seat the heel. Why? The more elegant pre-bunching can leave in place any pieces of grit that have embedded themselves in your soul from the imperfectly swept floor you walked on to get from the shower to your room, while the cruder, more direct method, though it risks tearing an older sock, does detach this grit during the foot's downward passage, so that you seldom later feel irritating particles rolling around under your arch as you depart for the subway.
When you started writing this novel, and you knew that it was going, that the narrative was going to be about how one puts on one's socks, how one unsheathes the straw, mm-hmm. how you take the Band-Aid out of its wrapping. Mm. Did you start becoming super aware of these details in your life in a way that you'd never been before? So was this your way of doing research?
Mm. It was more that I wanted to discover what one thinks about in a lunch hour. So I just started at the beginning mentally and went through it with as strong a visual sense as I possibly could, and that's what I ended up with. So I did research only in the way of pressing myself to provide more thought per unit of elapsed narrative time than anyone else had provided, I hoped.
When friends said to you, "So you're working on a book. What's it about?" What did you tell them?
I said it was about contemporary life and its problems. Being a little secretive about it.
And it is about that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very minor problems.
<Yeah. laughs> There's a passage I want you to read that I think perfectly illustrates how the mind in this book operates, in which it makes a whole list of the thoughts that it occupies itself with.
Well, the character is deciding that that it's wrong to take a snapshot of what thoughts are in your head, and that you have to find out what the frequency of thoughts are over a period of time. And so he goes on, "Just as the most frequent words in English are humdrum ones like of and in and the, so the most frequent thoughts are bland and tiresome things like itch on face, fleeting sexual image, and is my breath bad? But below the of and in level of thought vocabulary, there was a whole list of mid-frequency ideas. I imagine them taking the form of a chart, something like, and here's this big chart. And at the top of the list is L, who's the narrator's girlfriend, and he thinks about L 580 times a year, and then family 400.0 times, brushing tongue 150, earplugs 100, bill paying 52, Panasonic three-wheeled vacuum cleaner greatness of 45.0, sunlight makes you cheerful 40.0, traffic frustration 38.0, job should I quit 34.0. Friends, don't have any, 33.0. Marriage, a possibility, 32.0. Vending machines, 31. Straws don't unsheath well, 28. Shine on moving objects, 25. McCartney more talented than Lennon, 23. Friends smarter, more capable than I am, 19. Paper towel dispensers, 19. What oft was thought but ne'er, etc., 18. People are very dissimilar, 16. Trees, beauty of, 15. Sidewalks, 15. Friends are unworthy of me, 15. Identical twins separated at birth. Studies of traits, 14. And the list goes on, and it tapers down to, you can taste it with your eyes 4 times a year. Dry cleaning fluid, smell of, 3 times a year. Ziploc tops, 2.0. Popcorn, 1.0. Birds regurgitate food and feed young with it 0.5 times a year. And the last one is Kant Emmanuel at 0.5 times a year.
I'll tell you that in reading your book, I alternated between thinking, gee, I really identify with this, and thinking, this character really is a sociopath.
Well, that's, yeah, I worried about that, and I'm unhappy about that, because I wanted to write this and to reclaim this way of thinking to the normal camp, and not to write about a character who is obsessive in some clinical way, but who is a kind of a hobbyist of these things and just lets them revolve in his mind.
I don't know if this is at all on track, but there's something about it that reminded me of the Russian novel, where you know there's a character who's always walking around thinking and and examining and thinking about who's plant conspiring against him, and do you see any connection to that?
Yeah, I'm. Well, it's a connection with all novels, I hope, that have more thought than action. I mean, one of the things I wanted to do was make this novel as unfilmable as I possibly could. Not that anyone is dying to film anything I write, but just that I wanted to do the things that the novel could do well more completely than the things that that films could do better than novels. And so in that sense, that's one of the reasons why there's all this thought churning around.
What were your journals like when you were... Did you keep journals when you were a kid, little diaries?
No, I didn't. I wanted to be a composer, and so I kept little journals of musical ideas, but I didn't start writing down thoughts until I was, I don't know, 22 or so.
And then you started keeping a journal?
Yeah, I guess it was more... I started keeping something resembling a journal when I was about 25.
And what kinds of thoughts did you write down in it?
I tried to trace back exactly how, what had been the approximate cause of a thought and how that one had led to the next one. And I tried to give as thorough account of the moments of transition as possible. Because when you're reading somebody like Joyce, it's nice. I mean, it's wonderful. He's a genius. You read a sentence and he ends it with a period and then you have another sentence. But you just have this atomic sequence of thoughts as opposed to something more fluid in which you can really see the changes of phase between one thought and another. So I tried to teach myself to remember the moments of transition as opposed to the centers of the thought.
Has writing this novel changed the way you think in any way? Do you walk around thinking more about things like unsheathing straws and finding new shoelaces than you did before?
I think less about them. In one of the footnotes, I said that you can wear a thought out. And in trying to reconstruct some of the transitions and some of the ways the thought worked, it's like a jingle or like an over-memorized line of poetry. It loses its meaning. But I was walking by the studio, by the outside of the studio here, and I noticed the cast iron trunk collar that I wrote about. And there it said, Nina Foundry Company, Nina, Wisconsin. And there was a pleasant feeling that I'd already archived that in prose, so I didn't have to worry about it. But basically, it's a relief that there's 0.8% of the world that I think about when it's around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I've already written down somewhere. It's a pleasant feeling.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking to us about your writing and for reading some of your new book.
My pleasure.
Nicholson Baker's novel, The Mezzanine, has just been published in paperback by Vintage. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. President Gorbachev in the Soviet Union is leading the news again. He calls for a multi-party system in his country. Lots of changes going on there. We'll have that report and an analysis. President Bush makes a speech about global warming. There is an important ruling involving former President Ronald Reagan. He will have to provide videotaped testimony in the trial of former National Security Advisor John Poindexter. Also, a farewell to Mel Lewis, big band jazz drummer. He had a long career with Stan Kenton and many others, and he was the founder of the Thad Jones Mel Lewis Big Band that played every Monday night for the past 24 years at the Village Vanguard in New York City.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For the past few weeks, when there hasn't been a rerun, the TV show 30-something has been revolving around the character Nancy. She has ovarian cancer and is undergoing treatment. Critic Maureen Corrigan, who regularly watches the show, was talking to a friend recently about Eastern Europe, and one piece of news made her think about 30-something.
I know a woman who just returned from Romania, and she says about the only thing to watch on TV over there now is the old Spencer Tracy movie, Judgment at Nuremberg. This is a strange phenomenon, but it also brings symmetry to the Romanian Revolution. You might remember that the revolution exploded when the army took control of the state TV station. Now the Romanians are wondering what to do with their deposed leaders, so they've switched on the tube to get some ideas by watching Tracy punish the Nazis. When I first heard this story, I felt kind of guilty. The Romanians are watching TV to guide them through political transformations. Meanwhile, I'm watching 30-something to guide myself through personal relationships. But if the Romanians could watch the show, it would give them a sense of what their lives may be like if they do join us in the twilight carnival of late capitalism. Free-floating anxieties haunt the well-off, well-educated strivers on 30-something. They worry about losing their jobs, their youth, their marriages, and these days even their lives. Nancy's cancer is the most serious subject 30-something has tackled, but it's not really a departure in theme. Loss of control has threatened all the characters. Hope discovers her house has radon. Melissa finds herself falling in love with a man who's not her equal in age or status. Nancy's body goes haywire. For me, what saved the cancer episodes from being like one of those disease of the month movies has been 30-something's determination to show how one person's sickness often brings out the worst in other people. In particular, the desperate attempts of friends and lovers to preserve their own well-being. Where else on TV would you see a husband like Elliot, who deals with Nancy's cancer by going out and getting bombed with Michael?
I can get a new wife, Mike. No problem. I mean, who needs her? She's got stretch marks. She does. She's got stretch marks on her stomach.
Nancy's cancer has strained conversations. It's like she's emigrated to the land of the sick, and the other characters can't bring themselves to learn the native language.
Hi. You look great, Nancy. How are you feeling?
Oh, it just hurts from the cut.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I bet it does. Ugh.
But the 30-something crowd, who are supposed to be old friends, has always had trouble communicating. The single people don't understand the married people. The husbands and wives don't understand each other. Each one of the characters is doing hard time in what Nietzsche called the prison house of language. This season, the characters' communication problems have even splintered the form of the show. It focuses more on one character or couple. I miss the sense of community in the old 30-something, when characters would spontaneously gather at Hope and Michael's house. But this approach is much more realistic. Life gets more privatized as people get older. The Romanians certainly have a more compelling reason for watching TV than I do, but I think we're both using TV in similar ways, as a moral compass, pointing us to connections outside our own living rooms. No, I'm not saying that Gary's commitment problems are on a par with overthrowing a dictator, but 30-something continues to engage, with wit and intelligence, people's utopian yearnings for love and community, yearnings our own political culture barely registers.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Richard Parker, Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, and Thad Kirk. Roberta Shurrock directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, director Robert Young discusses Triumph of the Spirit, his new movie about the Holocaust, shot on location in Auschwitz. Also, Bud Schulberg looks back on writing On the Waterfront and tells us why he has no regrets about testifying before the House Un-American Activities Committee in the early 50s. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.